geopolitical commentator and investigative journalist. You're listening to Pella Nuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Nuroth-Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon from Malmo, Sweden's third largest city and host of the Eurovision Song Contest, which is supposed to be one of the world's largest musical festivals or cavalcades. It's a rather silly event. And you've got this, some people call it a freak show with somebody called Bambi Thug, I think, representing Ireland and decked out with all his or her team's satanic equipment and uniforms or gear or whatever, sitting watching their own performance from the stands. And of course, that leads me neatly into a presentation of my first guest, Oran McIntyre, who's written The Total States Liberal Democracies Become Tyrannies, who's a sort of voice of the Zoomers and a fast rising star economist for Blaze News. He criticizes the new atheists of the 2000s, people like Richard Hawkins and Christopher Hitchens, who I admired once upon a time. He's too wordy for his own good, but a very famous essayist and broadcaster. And they were absolutely savage in their condemnation of all religion. But as Oran McIntyre argues, well, when we've destroyed religion, what have we got left? A sort of moral vacuum. And perhaps the Eurovision Song Contest today is a manifestation of Europe's loss of identity. We've got our final guest this afternoon is Tim Kirby, who's an American-born media figure and former professional, semi-professional football player who's living in Russia. He's makes the case that you could settle there quite cheaply, you know, go east, young man sort of vibes about him. He produces beautiful travel videos of the volcanoes of Kamchatka, Siberia, and other places. And if Russia would only open up, it would be a good thing for all of us, and it's cheap to live there. Well, he's here to make that case. Anyway, we're going to have Basil in a couple of minutes, but we're just going to talk about, very interested as I am in the media, a sort of good news coming from New York City. Apparently, the New York Times' executive editor, Joe Kahn, I think his name is calling time on the absolutely terrible fake news tradition that's characterized American journalism in the last couple of years, Washington Post, New York Times and Atlantic being the worst offenders, which means lots of people turning to us at TNT to get x-ray vision and find out what's really going on in the world, not their propagandistic bromides. Well, he was talking to a magazine and quoted by Matt Taibbi, a well-known Substacker commentator and so on. And Joe Kahn was criticizing the large influx of Generation Z, poor thinkers, basically, from the Ivy League universities who couldn't tell their facts from their opinions. And he is sort of saying, well, you know, we've got to go back to becoming the newspaper record that we once were. And I remember just reading, I had a project that involved me reading a lot of American news coverage of events of the 1980s and 70s. And what I remember, it wasn't just my sort of imagination, things were better in the past, sort of wishful thinking or romanticized thinking. The articles, the New York Times was a much better newspaper in those. It was beautiful in its description. I mean, you could make a point, but you didn't have to hammer them over the head with it. And they were much more fact-based, longer, more thoughtful. And they were not, I mean, everyone famously says that British journalism was more vigorous and perhaps more literate. But when you felt you read the New York Times, you could take what the New York Times said to the bank. You felt it was solid and it represented sort of good side to America. But of course, in the 2010s, we had them going ape over Donald Trump to get clicks and subscriptions from their core readership, sort of professional men and women at the liberal and the neoliberal class living in Washington and New York, masters of the universe, supporting Clinton and with their very well-paid jobs in Manhattan, who thought unwashed Trump really was the devil. Well, anyway, here's some more quotes from Joe Kahn. That's quoted by, it was in a magazine in Semaphore magazine, S-E-M-A-F-O-R, where that whole interview is Joe Kahn. And he talks about, we can't turn ourselves into Xinhua and Pravda. Xinhua is the Chinese official news agency. Pravda is a famously propagandistic Soviet Russian newspaper, and put in a stream of stuff favorable to Biden. He said, it's the Democrats' job to win the elections. It's not our job to win the elections for them. If they can't win it on their own without our help, then they don't perhaps deserve to be elected. So let's hope the New York Times once again becomes a paper that is a paper of record, and then they can join us on the side of the good journalists, he said modestly. Anyway, we're going to have more good journalism, talking to Basil Valentine, who will be with us after a very short break. Our political editor has more of the day's news. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT. Back after the break.
Conversations to inform and include.
It's meant for everyday people to understand.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon, Basil. Welcome back again.
Good afternoon, Pelle. Great to see you too. Just to pick up on what you were saying about the New York Times there, I used to see it occasionally back in the day, and it had lyrical, almost elegiac descriptions of aspects of American life as well. If you remember, the articles about cultural and social life were extremely well written. I don't know if that's still the case or not.
I think the lifestyle and arts sections are less affected. I think the arts section has probably got a lot of wokery about it. There's much of American life. But there still are gems of journalism, I think. I mean, the journalists are still out there. So I guess I've got friends who subscribe to the New York Times and who have my political opinions and cherry pick the good stuff. So
I think, you know, you can write what you like so long as you don't stray off the reservation. And articles about sort of aspects of history or music or art or culture pose no threat to empire narratives. But when it comes to drumming up support for war or something, which seems to be one of their main jobs these days, then you've got to stick within. Go on.
You're going to say, I think that what you're going to talk about is the loss of American reputation. And I think
that's right.
If America starts to go back to the New York Times mode of modality, as it were, in many aspects, that's the sort of thing we admire America for. And more of that will restore America's reputation. But empire building and arrogance won't do that. And that's what your survey shows, I think.
That's right. Perception of the US, United States and Russia has been published online in a huge survey. This is the 2024 Democracy Perception Index, which was published this week and canvassed some 63,000 respondents across 53 countries. And it summarizes attitudes towards democracy, geopolitics and global power plays. America's international reputation has taken a big hit since early last year, particularly, of course, in Muslim countries, where Washington's unwavering support of Israel and its war in Gaza has proved intensely divisive. Europe has also joined the trend. Frederick DeVoe, senior researcher for the Latana survey company that compiled the index, said, for the first time since the start of the Biden administration, many Western European countries have returned to net negative perceptions of the United States. This rise and decline from negative attitudes under Trump to positive and back to negative attitudes is particularly stark in Germany, Austria, Ireland, Belgium, and Switzerland. Meanwhile, perceptions of China in particular, and also to a lesser extent Russia, have continued to climb. Latin America, now 24% favorability index towards China, whereas only 15% a year ago. In the MENA countries, it's risen from 19% to 30%. And globally, from neutrality, perceptions of China now positive by 5%. So there's no doubt whether you want to call it the propaganda wars, or simply the result of China spending money on building infrastructure all over the world and the United States then bombing that infrastructure into smithereens, it does appear that there's a growing sympathy towards the emerging BRICS countries, Pelle.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there are two sort of separate issues. One is if America, Russia and China are better, a lot of people would disagree with that. And then there's a second thing, which is the perception that China and Russia are better. which should worry even those in Britain and America who thinks Russia and China are the devil, right? So we're seeing a narrative that, and which they have to, I mean, they can't not face it if they are serious about diplomacy, because what's the alternative? Are they going to bomb the, are they going to start World War III so that Russia and China can't benefit from the fruits of their diplomacy or money or whatever, the long-standing perception that, you know, America's had its day, twitting the empire, you know, there's a strong feeling of liberation among much of the world. I mean, people get sort of fed up. However benign the American empire has been, some will argue, you know, like the Economist saying, well, you'll miss America when it's gone type of thinking. And that's a whole separate case from the perceptions that the West, especially the UK and America, have to fight. And of course, I think it's got to do with China building airports. You know, as the Kenyan leader said recently, China brings airports. You just bring finger wagging advice. You just tell us what to do all the time. And, you know, Western messianism. And the thing is, it's not out of the blue. It's not as if we have 5 minutes of China and 5 minutes of the West and each makes their case. We've had 80 years of the West, for good or for worse, telling the same old story, we're better than you. And then China's a relative newcomer and they don't make much of a fuss. And a lot of people will be critical of the way what's really going on behind the scenes, but it kind of looks good, or at least offers a change. And it's a big trading partner. There's a very useful map. Biggest trading partner in 1990 and biggest trading partner today. Biggest trading partner in 1990, the whole world was colored blue with a few exceptions. And that meant that America was the largest trading partner of nearly all the world's countries. Now it's like 80% red, which means China is the world's trading partner of the world's, nearly all the world's countries, maybe 10 or 15 that are still blue. I don't know. I don't even know if one's in Europe. So trade follows influence. You know, your money comes from China or your trade, and then you're going to like China, even though the West has considerable soft power still. So, yeah, it's interesting. If I were in Whitehall in Foreign Office or in State Department, I'd look at that survey and start thinking. What do you think?
That's the problem. I don't think they do think about it. I'm looking at an image here online on the Politico report with somebody holding a banner supposedly somewhere in Europe, with the message F the USA and a middle finger being raised. Now, the response from the airheads on Capitol Hill to that kind of thing isn't pause for reflection. It isn't to ask themselves what they're doing wrong. Instead, they tend to respond with condemnation and aggression. Everybody is wrong. They still cling to this American exceptionalism. We must be right. We are the best country in the world. We don't have any evidence for it, but we're simply telling you. And if you don't go along with it, then you're some kind of jerk, you know. Also, of course, on the trade front, the United States outsourced all its jobs. I remember Ross Perot saying that, with the NAFTA trade agreements and all the rest of it, that there's going to be a great sucking sound as all the jobs are exported. And that's exactly what's happened. So the United States is now on a sort of permanent war economy footing with a huge military industrial complex, countries propped up by an obscenely bloated so-called defense budget. But the middle class has been completely hollowed out. You know, the things that you could do in the 1950s, like buy a family home on the salary of a single employed auto worker. I mean, that's just one for the nostalgia books. Quality of life in America has deteriorated markedly. People working two or three jobs just to keep a roof over their heads. So-called SHIT life syndrome, which was one of the factors cited in Donald Trump's election. Not that it really made any difference, but an awful lot of people in America leading very tough, difficult lives because they're taxed to the hilt to pay for foreign wars and all sorts of other adventurism and wastes of money that capital thinks of. And nobody ever seems to speak up for the American people, Pelle.
Well, it's interesting that Trump's really going for, I asked a Trump pollster. It's always good to talk to pollsters because they're not just, they're like in the engine room of winning elections. And Trump is going to have much lower profile this time around. He doesn't do his fake news, lock her up type rhetoric, which fun though it was for 2016. But he's more statesmanlike, and he's apparently trying to win over all those liberal, if you like, college graduate generation who simply can't get a job or get onto the housing ladder and produce the next generation of Americans, you know? And that's a tragedy. Educated young women loving Biden and the Democrats, but Biden and the left, if you like, their policies have led to them not being able to get families or men with jobs who can enable them to start families and all the rest of it. So they've become bitter, childless 40-year-olds who own a cat sort of thing.
Yes, absolutely. And that's been the case in the UK as well. I mean, can you think of a single flagship Biden policy that has benefited ordinary Americans, be they working class, middle class, or anybody but the billionaires who made a fortune off the vaccines? Can you think of a single Biden initiative, Pelle? I can't.
No, one. Probably not. No.
You know, nothing leaps to mind.
So you're off to France next week. I guess we'll have your reports from there.
Yes, indeed. We're taking a brief sojourn from Valentine Towers, and normal service will be resumed on Monday at the usual time.
Okay, well, look forward to good luck with your trip, and we'll talk to you again on Monday. This is the Pelle Neroff Taylor Show on TNT News Talk here from Malmo, back with our third guest, I think, after a very quick break.
TNT. Sonia Paulton.
I am delighted to see that Parliament will finally be turning its gaze towards SLAP today. This is strategic litigation against public participation, and it is a recognised tactic that wealthy people use often against journalists, researchers and publishers, and they do it by using the law courts and with the aim of draining their target financially and psychologically, and with the purpose of silencing them. This has been going on for a very, very long time, and it's outrageous that more has not been done about it. Too many people have been able to hide behind the British law courts to pursue those whose job it is to document our world.
Sonia Paulton on today's News Talk, TNT. In a democracy, the majority vote rules. But in most democracies, you can only vote for change every 3 or 4 years. To understand what people want, governments and political parties use focus groups. These focus groups can include as little as 20 people. Australia is a country of over 25 million people. Does making decisions based on 20 people sound fair to you? Have your say. Be heard in between elections. Download the For My Say app now. That is number 4, My Say.
You are about to hear
today's News Talk and the voice of freedom.
That's what this country's all about.
Today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroff Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. Well, we've got Aaron McIntyre, who's a columnist for The Blaze and blazing a trail through the conservative opinion sphere. He's the host of the Aaron McIntyre Show. And he, to quote a review, in short order, has rocketed from obscurity to becoming the voice of a new generation on the right. He's, as a commentator noted, he sets the tone more than most prime time cable news hosts. He's fed up with libertarian bromides and the seemingly unstoppable left. Zoomers and young millennials are flocking to his daily commentary and try to figure out what they can do to promote a healthy civil society. Welcome to the show. Well, that's a nice write-up, isn't it?
Yeah, incredibly kind words. Thank you so much.
Well, it wasn't my words, but I guess you. Well, we'll start off. We've got many topics that we could talk about, but just to sort of, I'm trying to get a commonality of theme here because I'm in. I don't know if you've heard of the Eurovision Song Contest. It's this ridiculous annual event that gathers together all of Europeans in a sort of song equivalent to the World Cup. And it's becoming more degenerate by the year. And now we've got one of the favorites. A number of Irishmen or Irish non-binary characters dressed out as devils. And, you know, whereas a generation ago, these were young, svelte French-speaking women singing about love and peace. And now it's all... You've been complaining, I think, in a recent article about... Well, rather, you've been highlighting, you know, heroes. I thought heroes a generation ago with people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, and their aggressively anti-religious rhetoric and language. But you feel that these smart guys are kind of thrown out the baby with the bathwater in a way, and that we've sort of become, it wasn't such a good idea to de-Christianize ourselves in America and in Western Europe. We've lost something. Is that something that you would like to pick up on?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, we saw this with Richard Dawkins recently. Ayaan Hirsi Ali also did this beforehand, I think in a more genuine way. She seems to be actually interested in pursuing faith. But both of them recognized that despite the fact that they thought they were bringing enlightenment and truth, getting rid of the last little bit of Bronze Age ideology that was holding back the glorious and inevitable future of the West, what they were actually doing was just stripping out the final pieces of foundation that were holding up the very world that they revered. And now that they've done that successfully, they're shocked to find that all of the cathedrals didn't become some kind of monument to science, but in fact, they became mosques. And it turns out that human beings are religious creatures, not just because they're backwards and stupid, but because the metaphysical is real and true, and it's what animates us as a society. And that once you get rid of that, you don't just end up with some kind of highly advanced set of people. What you end up with is a soulless people who can't prefer themselves to any others and are eventually conquered by those that still have that animating fervor.
I was reading some of your articles and posts, and I haven't read your book yet, apologies. But I find there's a lot to agree with, a lot of thoughtful and sort of moderate. What would you say you bring to the conservative dialogue? What is it that's made you such a sort of, I don't know, shining star or whatever? I mean, what's your USP?
I guess the big thing is that I've looked at a lot of thinkers outside of the traditional conservative sphere. There's a very set, a rote way to think about right-wing politics or the way we should understand our culture. And it's mostly ideological. It's set in some kind of neoconservative version of modernity. But I think our problems go much deeper to a conception of who we are as a people and how we order our society. And I think there are a lot of people who warned us about this. They warned us that this was coming. And what we're really seeing is just the natural fruition of the things that we've sown. We're really just getting what we asked for, and what we are getting is quite horrible. And so I think that maybe the reason I stand out a bit is it's not so much about conserving the current system. I don't think we should be conservative in that way. The current system is a failure. I think what we need is a restoration, an understanding of who we are and how we can become a vibrant and, you know, really a kind of community that will better our lives rather than one that is simply pushing along towards some idea of progress.
So give us a few examples of what policies we should adopt that restore our civil society to the state that you'd like.
Sure, a really simple one that I think everyone probably in the West at this point who's not completely on the left understands is the issue of immigration. We've left borders open for a very long time, and different countries have done that for different reasons. Some have said purely economic, others have said they have duties to refugees, some have a dedication to multiculturalism. But whatever the ideology, it seems that the answer has always been to leave borders open. And we're seeing that across the West, this is a devastating idea, not just because there's a impact on the systems and the ability of social safety nets to upkeep each other, though that is certainly an issue, but that there's an actual problem with exchanging the people inside the nation for another set of people, that not all people are fungible widgets who magically adopt your way of life and your values the minute they settle on the magical soil in your home. That actually there are particular ways of being that people inhabit because of their traditions, their folkways, their culture, their religions. And that if you just leave your borders open, it radically creates a revolution demographically and culturally inside your country. And so if we want to be able to say, get back to an idea of who we are and how we should treat each other and how we should order our societies, first, we have to have stable populations and cultures, even if that does mean a certain level of diversity inside. For instance, the United States has always been a very large country with very different cultures across different regions. But we had at least had a fixed understanding of how we related to each other, because there was still a border that actually secured the population and made sure we were always working within the same dynamic. We knew what we owed to each other and how to relate to each other. And you can't do that when you constantly have a shift in the population.
And this is a subject that immigration, I'm very interested in, because I've seen how Sweden, which is a very homogeneous country where I'm based at the moment, has changed utterly. And it used to be a high trust country, ethnically homogeneous, and high trust means lower transaction costs, and everybody knew what everyone else was thinking, more or less. And a lot of Swedes thought that was quite a bit boring, and they longed for the, and they watched too much Sesame Street. We're so Americanized in our culture that we take upon all these liberal nostrums coming from New York television studios. And you can't just transpose that without having regard to the rest of America's history. Anyway, it's ended up as a disaster because people didn't trust each other anymore. But we'll talk more about that after the break. This is Pelle Nerolf-Taylor Show. We've got a minute's news, and then we'll bring Aaron McIntyre back for more on the new conservatism. Thanks a lot.
The conversation continues.
You guys are awful positive today for what we're witnessing. It's that division that they want to push.
Now, TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The U.S. Senate has passed a five-year reauthorization of the Federal Aviation Administration with an 88-4 vote, sending the amended bill back to the House for expected approval next week. Michael Byrne, a Republican in New Jersey, is urging that the state should not be overlooked as an easy win for President Joe Biden in the upcoming election, citing a strong grassroots movement supporting former President Donald Trump.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nerolf-Taylor Show, broadcasting from Malmo on this Friday afternoon. We've got Aaron McIntyre, author of The Total State, How Liberal Democracies Became Tyrannies, which you haven't even breached yet. But from what I've seen, I mean, you have so many insights about what's going on. You talk about the conservatives being obsessed, don't understanding the realities of power in the West the way the left does. And so we have this absolutist discussion of about abortion, which Trump wants to leave to the states, probably quite wisely, whereas the conservatives want to have a federal abortion ban, which will totally alienate young women. And it's just not practical to do that because they won't win the election. But we're not going to talk about that immediately. We're going to talk about the Jeremy Carl book, Jeremy Carl we both admire for plain speaking about how whites have become a sort of unprotected class. You interviewed him recently. What do you make of his thesis?
I think Jeremy's absolutely right. He understands the problem is multifaceted. In the United States, we basically created a second constitution called the Civil Rights Act that circumvented all of the protections that were supposed to be applied to our population and instead created a specific set of carve-outs to favor, you know, minorities inside the United States. This was done initially with the idea of trying to dismantle the systems of segregation that had existed previously. I think a lot of people understood the importance of that. But in the meantime, it's become this basically, you know, racist system that puts the thumb on the scale in the favor of non-whites and throughout the country in every situation. But the problem isn't just legal, though that's huge. It's also cultural. The incentives at pretty much every turn are to prefer people who are non-white. And it's become very clear that there's no legal or cultural recourse for those who are subject to this bias. And the worst part is that for the majority of this, the Republican Party, the conservatives have bought into this at every turn. In fact, to this day, they still champion themselves as the true inheritors of the civil rights movement. And so we really end up with a scenario where there is no voice for a growing group of people who understand that while they were in the majority at one point, they're quickly becoming the minority and they have no legal protections in the meantime.
Mm. It's interesting. I was talking to Trump's pollster the other day, and he was saying that, Trump is less sort of bombastic and rhetorical and fun in a way. He's more serious, partly perhaps because he's been tied up by all these trials and cases. But he's trying to reach out to young people who might not be natural Trumpists, but are socked by this high cost of living. Angry whites, college whites who don't get the jobs they think they deserve. They can't go on the housing ladder. They can't start families. And then young mums who also might be sort of sympathetic to the Democrats, but who hate the way that U.S. school system has evolved into this anti-white screed. And I guess Trump could pick that up. But are you saying that the rest of the Republican, because he seems to be quite sensitive to the cultural issues that you're talking about, the white non-protected class. But are you saying that the rest of the Republican Party have bought into this diversity, equity, and inclusion stuff? I didn't know that.
Oh, absolutely. On a regular basis, they go ahead and trumpet their DEI bromides. We saw this in the Republican primary, where we had Nikki Haley talking about how I'm an immigrant woman, and so I'd be the first of this and that, and that's why you need to elect me. They're completely tone deaf to what's happening there. There is a growing number of people who understand this. There are some people who are very good on this, like J.D. Vance. So it's not the entire GOP, but a majority of them, yes, they do buy into this ideology.
Could you just, we've got a couple of minutes to talk about maybe the total state. What's your overarching theme of that book?
Well, like I said, for a lot of talk radio conservatives, general GOP voters, I was one of these people. I was working as a local news reporter, and you know, I saw what happened in 2016 with Trump, the way the media treated him. And then in 2020, when the pandemic came, the lockdowns, the churches were closed, but the strip clubs were open and no one was allowed to go see their mother's funeral, but the left was allowed to riot in the streets and burn down buildings. And it just became very clear that the Constitution, the Bill of Rights and the separation of powers and all these things that I had learned in, believed in when I was a young conservative, they simply weren't stopping tyranny. It was still occurring. And so I went on a political journey. I looked into a lot of thinkers that were outside of the box and kind of discovered that there was actually a long history of people on the right who had warned about this coming, that said we were on this path. And a big part of this was the fact that so much of the government has now grown well beyond the idea of the three branches that were placed into the U.S. Constitution. All the formal government that was supposed to be restricted by the things the founders put in the Constitution basically doesn't do the governing anymore. Yes, a lot of the power has been installed into the deep state. Many people call it the unelected bureaucracy in the executive branch. But it's also been shifted into the media. It's been shifted into corporations. And very importantly, it's been shifted into globalist NGOs that now dictate things like medical policy or election policy to what is supposed to be a sovereign nation. And so that's why I wrote The Total State, because I wanted to explain how this shift occurred and hopefully how we could address it.
So basically, we've become de-individualized in the sense of we're controlled by people who control our information, our smartphones, our schooling system. And the deep state is almost deliberately amorphous, because if you to define it more clearly, it just gets too complicated. But I think we can all understand something when we talk about it. And it's almost like the Matrix or something like that. It's a world view that doesn't... that's what you sort of mean, that it's omnipresent, and it's an alliance of powerful corporations and institutions and state institutions, isn't it? And we have to liberate ourselves as individuals from that somehow. But how can we do that?
Well, very interestingly, my message is really that individualism is the problem. The problem with liberalism, exactly. And here I mean classical liberalism, not just the left in the United States, is the idea that every rational individual would make choices from themselves. But what we're learning very quickly is that if the ruling class wants to manipulate elections and ideas, the best thing for them to do is to simply control the media, control the flow of information, like you were saying, and pipe that into the individual to make it impossible for them to make rational choices. And so really the things that protect us from this constant flow of propaganda are actually the concentric circles of organic community that we used to live in, the family, the church, the civic organizations that we were a part of, the mutual aid societies, even the labor unions at some point, were all things that pushed back against the centralizing power of the state. But slowly we've given up those duties and responsibilities to each other, and we've decided that the state should raise our children, the state should educate them, they should take care of our aged parents, they should handle our medical care, they should do all the things that used to be a part of us as a community and a people. And as we have given up those duties, we have also given up the power, and the state has now controlled all of those spheres that once pushed back against this constant idea of propaganda. And so they've been able to manipulate and control what is supposed to be an ever-expanding democracy. And I think Really, that's the problem, is without that organic pushback from local community and understanding, we can't fight the power of an increasingly decentralized but still totalitarian total state.
Well, it's interesting. It's sort of like Edmund Burke, isn't it? Edmund Burke talking about the little platoons of loyalty. And I completely get what you're saying now. I mean, as individuals, and we will extol individualism, that's in the liberal century that we've lived in, we're not strong enough somehow, or we become very vulnerable to the totalizing power of corporations and propaganda and media. And we need to expand the sphere of the local and the familial, and maybe local churches and local organization, local institutions. Well, that's quite interesting. I mean, it makes sense. And do you think this sort of thing can work in a Republican Party that is very sort of quite interested in power in Washington, which in some ways is part of the deep state as well? Because your thing is very much aimed at relatively powerless, quite small organizations and institutions. How can you thread them together to become a sort of a power in itself in the United States and the West?
Well, this is the part of the book that no one's going to like, but it's the truth, so I do my best to tell it, even if it's not popular.
Yeah.
And the fact is that we have really scaled human organization well beyond what it's intended to be. The Bible is very clear that the Tower of Babel is a bad thing, that actually we're not supposed to be governed by giant, faceless organizations that span the globe, but instead we're supposed to have a system of subsidiarity. We're supposed to be governed by organic nations that are built of people who work together. And the fact is that really the United States and much of the West have created this vast empire that's increasingly governed by people who don't care about those that they rule. And the only way that this is going to end is probably that some of those institutions start to fall apart. And we're already seeing this. We're seeing the problem of competency in our systems, the fact that there's a collapse of the ability for the just-in-time delivery system of our logistics to continue to be efficient, the fact that in the United States, we have a problem upkeeping basic things like our infrastructure. That's all having problems. And so what you're seeing is that a lot of state governors, like my governor, Ron DeSantis in Florida, are taking the initiative. They're pushing back against a lot of what the federal government is demanding of them. Sorry, we're not going to enforce this law that basically makes it criminal for girls to have their own sports league. Sorry, we're not going to go ahead and enforce your COVID mandate. Mm. We're going to figure out how to educate our children. We're going to figure out how to take care of our community. The federal government can go pound sand. And I think increasingly, that's what's going to allow for healthy communities, is for regional governorship to rise up and say, sorry, but if the central system is, you know, deciding to destroy us, we're going to push back against it.
Aaron, are you sort of saying, I think we're going to start winding up here now, but does the United States have a future as a united country of 350 million people?
I am somewhat skeptical. I'm long on the American people, but I'm short on the current American regime. I think that ultimately the founders were very clear that our system was meant to be a federated one, one that was these United States, not the United States. It was supposed to be small communities and states who governed themselves and then combined together in order to form a union that was more beneficial to each state. It was not supposed to be one vast centralized government that really has moved well beyond the borders of even the 50 states and now runs a giant system that reaches into Europe and all other places across the globe.
Aaron McIntyre, thank you very much. That was a very vivid and interesting description, and your theory makes total sense. And I'd love to talk to you again. Author of The Total State, How Liberal Democracies Became Tyrannies, the host of The Aaron McIntyre Show, and economist for Blaze News, rising star. Thank you very much, Aaron. This is the Pelle Neroff Taylor Show on Friday afternoon. Over to our next guest. Thanks.
Thank you.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride with being part of these multi-generational businesses, but there's also a significant amount of pressure. My senior year of high school, my dad made the decision that this world no longer needed him in it. I don't know if he was overwhelmed by the bills and checks that weren't going to be coming in because of the strawberries dying off, but it breaks my heart that my dad made a permanent decision for a temporary issue. Don't feel like you have to go through it alone.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
in the mornings. That's my time, watching the sun come up. I can have a cup of coffee and exercise if I want to. It helps me start the day with a sense of gratitude.
Yay!
Every day is a new opportunity. Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
My character Shazam knows all about growing up in a family full of teenage superheroes. They're bold.
Where's everyone going?
To fight crime.
Okay.
Adventurous.
Shazam!
There's never a dull moment. And no matter what happens, they'll always have your back. All they need is a place to grow and be themselves. And the best part is, you don't have to be a superhero to adopt a teen. Learn more about adopting a teen from foster care. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward.
I tell my son, I love you every single day.
I love you.
Now, my dad has never said that to me. Not because he doesn't love me, but because culturally it wasn't comfortable for him. Now that he's a grandfather, he says, I love you to my son every time he sees him. My advice to all the fathers out there, forget the cultural restrictions. They grow up way too fast for you to waste even a single precious moment.
Coming to you live from Sweden, you're with Pelle Nyroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pelle Nyroth-Taylor Show on this Friday afternoon. Our final guest is Tim Kirby, who's an American living in Russia. He's been living there for 20 years. And I think we can look at him as a pair of Western eyes on this often misunderstood country. And I'm saying that as I'm visiting a place which is on the Straits of Øresund, which is a sort of connecting point between Russia and Baltic Sea and the Atlantic. And half of Russian trade goes through here in anonymous supertankers and cargo vessels. And this narrow straits over to Denmark is only 30 kilometers, 4 kilometers at the narrowest point, could be a choke point if NATO gets into war with Russia. And already talk among the Danish military that they're eager to get into the Russians just to blockade their shipping, which of course would be an act of war, which would mean war in this very peaceful corner of the world, which none of us wants. But such is the state of the world today. So I'm relying on Tim to spread the word and perhaps give us a more nuanced country that's so often been demonized. He's a semi-professional American football player, and he'll be telling us about how American football is received in Russia. But I think the thing we'll start off with is you've done a series of videos, Tim, on buying a house in Russia as a foreigner. That's interesting. Yeah. What happens? Because it's quite cool. Is it easy to buy a house? I mean, and is it a cool prospect? Yeah.
No. One of the unfortunate things is over the last few years, I actually have been participating in a Duma committee about migration, how to change things. And the one thing is that the wheels of politics are very tough to turn. Okay. And I see that a lot of Western foreigners do want to move to Russia. In fact, one project I created, you may have heard about, called The American Village. I'm the starter of that. Unfortunately, that's not really working out that well. But long story short, there are a lot of things that make it extremely difficult, if not impossible, for Western foreigners to move to Russia. There's a large set of bureaucratic barriers. Essentially, the number one barrier is that each Russian region has a migration quota. Okay. And basically, without some sort of a legal foothold to get through this migration quota, you're not getting in here. Generally, that's being married to a Russian citizen. That's probably the most common one. But otherwise, if you're already married and you already have kids, especially if someone is very religious, they look at Russia as the Holy Land is a great place to move to. But the migration system does not agree. And it is very difficult to get here. About the prospects of buying a house, one of the main issues is foreign people are not allowed to own land in Russia. That's a big issue. So people write me very often because I'm somewhat popular, let's just say, in this sphere of Westerners who move to Russia. And they're always so sure that they can just go buy a ranch somewhere. And it's just like, nope, you can't. Only people with Russian citizenship can own Russian land. So it works out that foreigners can really only buy like apartments and stuff. Of course, there's a way around this, a legal way around this that I've put together with my good lawyer friend, which is going to be sort of the phase two of the American Village, where we're going to help people buy homes using fully legal means within Russia that are somewhat located close to each other in the Moscow region, as in the region around Moscow.
Because one of the things, I mean, trade and tourism reduces tensions. Whatever the West has done wrong in its relationship with Russia, Russia hasn't exactly gone out of its way to attract tourists. I mean, I'm surprised, long after the end of communism, you still needed this visa stuff where you had to show where you lived every night of your stay. And Ukraine abolished those rules, incidentally, but Russia still had them. So very few Scandinavians go to Russia, at least Swedes. I know Finns have a more better relationship. And I think there's a lot to see there and a hell of a lot to learn. Have you pushed, I mean, are you politically active in trying to make it easier to live in Russia, to immigrate to Russia, to be a tourist in Russia?
Within reason. When this program began, the voice said that you're in Sweden. I don't want to have the Swedish setup. I don't want to have the European Union setup. I'm not interested in that. However, I do think that Russia's immigration system, which is actually more or less controlled by the Ministry of Internal Affairs and not so much the equivalent of like a Russian State Department or the Foreign Ministry. So that means it has a very different character. It's a lot more pessimistic and focused on keeping people out. Because if you're a policeman, less people, less problems. You see what I mean? So I am a big advocate that Russia, I've given speeches at the State Duma where I think it needs to be more like a sports team where the Russian authorities need to adjust the system in order to really try to be to attract certain types of people that they need. Even President Putin himself has come out in favor of immigration from the West. But unlike what you've been told, he is not the God Emperor, and we have a Western style system here. So there's a lot of bureaucracy and, again, a lot of gears to move. Things are not so simple. Even if the boss says that he wants something done, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get done. Visas. Here's one thing is visas are actually, I would say, in some ways a good thing. Yes, it adds a hurdle that makes people not come here as much. But at the same time, have you ever tried to hire someone or I don't know, probably hiring someone and you want to test to see some sort of minimal level of competency? The visas are kind of like a minimum level of competency to see if someone can enter your country. If they're a complete moron or not, if they can write their own name on a piece of paper when told to do so. Because you'd be surprised, man. I've had to hire a lot of people over the years to do this, that, and the other. And there are some people where they simply cannot follow directions. They're just not, it's not in the cards. So.
So, I'm quite critical of the West European immigration policy, which is totally changing our countries. So you have a sympathetic audience here. Do you think, does the West have a lot of misconceptions about Russia?
Yes, absolutely, 100%. Going back for hundreds of years, this is nothing new. It was even the case before the Cold War. As my one good friend and journalist, Andrei Afanasyev, put it, they've hated us since the schism between the Eastern Orthodox and Catholic Church. So that seems to be sort of the moment when Russia became the bad guy as the representative of the, quote, wrong type of Christianity.
Yeah. Didn't you do some... let's start off with something less contentious, and we've only got 6 minutes, unfortunately. But didn't you do some travel videos?
If you want to be contentious, man, let's be contentious. Why not? If you want.
No. What I mean is, it's a big topic. So I talk about Russia almost every day on the show, and the Russian-Ukraine conflict. It's just I just don't know where to start within the constraints of the interview. But you're the same guy who made all these travel videos of Russia, right?
Yeah. I've gone all over the country. At some point in time, I filmed like 2/3 of those states. Yeah.
You make the country, because obviously, let's say we all extol America as a country of fantastic contrast and fantastic scenery. And the Daily Telegraph UK said America is the best destination in the world. You know, it's like a week ago, that's the UK's main right-wing paper. But of course, it stands to reason that a country like Russia, which is more than twice the size of the United States and also spans many time zones, also have a lot of sights and fantastic scenery and potential bungee jumping and hiking and romantic sunsets, obviously. But we almost never see any of that. We just see maybe St. Petersburg and high rises, and people still think there are food queues and that sort of thing. But you can you tell us, I mean, tell us a little bit about the beauty and the scenery of Russia that would make it a fantastic tourist destination.
Well, I mean, one thing just that I tell everyone, first off, is that you could find natural beauty absolutely everywhere and in all the countries of the world. Maybe not so much in the Vatican because they have no more nature left. So maybe they're the exception. But everywhere else you can find natural beauty, and Russia included. But, you know, the thing that about Russia that's really, I would say, impressive is again, you mentioned how big it is. But you could really feel that bigness when you're traveling around, you know, like. If you look at a map of Russia, the other day I took my daughter to go see the fortress in Derbent, which is in Dagestan. And the train ride wasn't really that crazy long. But if you look on a map, it looked like we went 1 millimeter, you know, after traveling for like an hour. And you're seeing all these new buildings being built and new houses and cows and goats and beautiful mountains and the Caspian Sea. And then you go up and you see this ancient fortress built by the Persians/Iranians, whatever you want to call them, in these very, very ancient times, and how the city has sort of evolved to like grow around this ancient fortress in Derbent. And, you know, it's really something. I mean, you like we've done some other cool stuff, like doing the traditional Tiven style wrestling out there with the Tivens in their ethnic republic, which is near Mongolia. You know, you're out on the barren steppe with the golden sun and all that stuff, trying to throw each other around. Good times, man. And yeah, there's a lot to Russia. Russia is really big, and all these different ethnic republics, although they do often have a lot of similarities to each other in some ways. But you definitely see a very different universe.
I was going to say, you were just talking about all this new building. It's hard to say when we're sitting here in a studio, you know, what a country really looks like. And of course, you know, Tucker Carlson went to Russia 2 months ago, and he went to the supermarkets, and they look absolutely fantastic. And central Moscow looks fantastic. And he said, well, we were propagandized about Russia. And of course, he gets a lot of pushback. Putin's agent, Putin's press officer, saying, well, the rest of Russia is garbage. It's all incredibly poor. That's not what Tucker Carlson captured. Whereas I'm sort of tending to say Russia's on the rise, whatever it was before, and it's much richer than it was before. What is the reality of wealth in Russia? Is there a lot of new building and elegant stuff, or is it garbage out in the countryside?
There's a lot of new stuff being built. The thing is that Russia is very hard to exactly put into that framework. There are so many places out in the middle of nowhere where you'll see a brand new building next to a building that's been remodeled, as in the owner tried their best to make this old building that they were maybe born in or their grandfather's born in, and try to make this house into something nicer, and they do their best. And then you'll see it next to a building that's completely flipped, the roof fallen down, and it's abandoned. So Russia, in a lot of ways, is very random. You can see the contrast of big new money, people kind of making buy, and people have just given up in the same place. You can see that kind of a tendency in the Caucasus Mountains, where I'm at right now. You can see that around Moscow. That's sort of everywhere. So there is a lot of construction going on. a lot of stuff is getting built, which is driving up the prices for homes, which is really unfortunate when you want to start a project for foreigners to buy homes in Russia. The prices just keep going up because the demand does not go down. The thing about Russia as a nation getting wealthier is true. Is the average person living like a 1950s American lifestyle, in terms of they go to some job as a plumber and they can have 50 million kids and a wife who doesn't work? No, that is not the case. I don't want to take it that far. But I think the situation is doing pretty good economically here.
Tim, we've got about a minute left. So could you just say, so a lot of people inside the Washington Beltway, a lot of people ought to know better perhaps, call Russia a gas station with nukes. How accurate or inaccurate is that statement? You've got 45 seconds.
Well, the war in Ukraine has proved that to be untrue, because Russia's industrial power has been laid before the world, and even Russia's capacity to do complex things like make computer chips and all that. So you could see, at least on that level, there's no problem. And the Russian economy has been faring better since the beginning of the war than pretty much the entire West in terms of that. But purchasing power, the PPP, Russia's number 5 or number 4 in the world. So, the whole gas station thing, that might apply to some places, but it doesn't apply to here.
Mm. Tim Kirby, thank you very much. American-born media figure in Russia, political analyst and semi-professional American football player. Really interesting and intriguing view insider. We'd love to have you on again, and we follow your YouTube channel talking about living, buying properties, and fantastic travel
on YouTube
videos.
Tim Kirby Travels. Tim Kirby's Travels on YouTube. Tim Kirby's Travels. You'll find it easy.
Okay, Tim. Thanks a lot. This is the Pellinero Telly Show. See you on Monday. Thanks a lot.